is Jeff Spittler, July 2nd, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 30. Okay, last time, which was 2 weeks ago, we covered sort of what's become a recurring theme, how Charles' intransigence in listening to anyone finally resulted in the writing and subscribing of the National Covenant. Okay, and he, of course, viewed this as a seditious document. We covered how the covenant was widely but not universally signed, and how when Charles heard news of this, he referred to the tables being the Committee of Estates that was sort of an alternative to Parliament, as stables of unruly horses, and now the first dung which from these stables was thrown upon the face of authority and government was that lewd covenant and seditious band annexed unto it. The outcome of this was somewhat of a foregone conclusion. Both sides began arming themselves. Charles went through a series of diplomatic maneuvers to stall for time. In fact, many of his sort of disingenuous instructions to his representative have been recorded for posterity. And he was very much a Machiavellian ruler. If you remember the quote that I read from Machiavelli a few weeks ago. Okay, one of these maneuvers, though, ways to stall for time was to say that they could have a general assembly, and the Covenanters took that seriously and went and held one. They elected commissioners from the presbyteries, and they finally began meeting on the 21st of November, 1638, in Glasgow. Okay, whereas the let's see, if we think about the reign of James and a number of the general assemblies held during that time, we saw how one after another these sort of incremental changes were made to the church government, the worship, and how they were was accomplished by James either packing the assembly and appointing his own commissioners and the various ways of doing this. But in the end, he basically intimidated and or flattered enough commissioners to sort of get his way. And this went over a number of general assemblies. This general assembly is quite a different story. The elections were held pretty freely. It began with a series of contests over who was to be appointed moderator, clerk, etc. And the King's Commissioner, the Marquis of Hamilton, had a series of protests prepared. But after those were dismissed, Alexander Henderson, this was the minister, well, at one time from Lucars, but most recently from Edinburgh, who was also helped author the National Covenant. He was elected as moderator on the second day of the assembly. It took the whole first day for all these protests to be settled. Now, on the third day, the assembly elected a clerk, and Hamilton wanted Thomas Sandilands elected as clerk. He had the registers of the General Assembly since 1590. Archibald Johnston of Warriston, right, another one of the authors of the National Covenant, was elected instead, and he was able to produce the five volumes of the registers of the General Assembly that covered the time period from 1560 to 1590. That was the time when the church had enjoyed its greatest freedom, as you were, with relatively little interference from the king. And then for several more days, a number of the commissions were examined. 13 of the 112 were examined because of irregularities. For example, there were two rival presbyteries of Aberdeen. Right? Aberdeen was the area of the country that was most prolatical, Episcopalian, and that they had a sort of an Episcopalian presbytery, and they also had a covenanting presbytery, and they both sent representatives, or both sent commissioners to the assembly. Okay, so once these commissions had been examined and in some cases tried, they were ready to begin their serious work. It took till the sixth, this was the sixth day of the meeting, so it took basically a whole week to get down to a serious business. But I know most of us tend to think of all this sort of committee stuff as, you know, kind of boring, passe stuff. And it probably is most of the time when things aren't contentious. But as we've seen before, this was actually the mechanism, in many respects, that the king had used to get his way and to change the church. Oops. Okay, now here the covenanters basically are able to force things to go the other way, so they get their choice of moderator and choice of clerk. Okay, well, the first serious item of business was the bishops had a declinature. Right? We've heard this term declinature before, when some of the Presbyterian ministers declined the authority of the Privy Council to try them for ecclesiastical crimes. In this case, the bishops had written a document to basically protest the whole meeting, saying it was a seditious gathering. Their specific reasons included that some representatives had been elected prior to the calling of assembly. Some representatives opposed the office of bishop, which had been established by law. That's an understatement. Almost all of them opposed the office of bishop. Some representatives were from presbyteries which had deposed their constant moderators. Right? Those were the bishops that had been appointed to, again, by a parliamentary or committee style tactics had been imposed on the presbytery as sort of permanent moderators. And after the National Covenant, they were deposed by a number of the presbyteries, and so they complained that those presbyteries were not properly constituted. Also, that the representatives were partisans, rebels, and schismatics. And according to one contemporary account, some did smile, others laugh and jeer at it whilst it was a reading. The assembly ordered written replies to be drafted, but they did not accept the bishop's declinature. Right, so it was just thrown out. Okay, the Marquis of Hamilton, at this point, he had actually invoked the assembly with the authority of the king. He decided to discharge the assembly. Because he knew now they were going to get down to sort of the serious, now that they've sort of done everything that they could that was purely organizational, they were going to get down to sort of serious business. So he ordered the assembly to dissolve in the king's name. And then he walked out of the assembly. Well, actually, the way was blocked because the door was locked, but once they broke the door down to let him out, then it was, he walked out. Alexander Henderson gave the General Assembly then a short address, which concluded with, "We perceive His Grace," that's the Marquis of Hamilton, "my Lord Commissioner, to be zealous of His Royal Master's commands. Have not we as good reason to be zealous towards our Lord and to maintain the liberties and privileges of His kingdom?" So they did not consider the assembly to be dissolved. They continued to meet. In fact, they met for about 2 weeks more, till maybe a little bit more like 2.5 weeks. They went on to pass 72 acts, and also disciplined a number of the bishops and archbishops. They deposed them all. Mostly with some of the clauses were quite serious, and some basically amounted to just being bishops, and so voting in the National Assembly, which was a violation of the cautions given, I think, in the General Assembly of 1600 when they agreed to have bishops. They said, okay, but they put this series of cautions on, which King James agreed to. And then they immediately ignored those cautions. So, if nothing else, they were all guilty of that. Let's see, the acts of the assembly included condemning the 6 previous assemblies. Let's see, 2 in Linlithgow, Glasgow, Aberdeen, St. Andrews, and Perth. And every one of them, this is a quote from the records of the Church of Scotland, and every one of them to have been from the beginning unfree, unlawful in all assemblies, and never to have had, nor hereafter to have, any ecclesiastical authority, and their conclusions to have been and to be of no force, vigor, nor efficacy. I guess that in itself would have condemned the 5 Articles of Perth and the Book of Common Prayer, but they specifically did that. In fact, the record of the Church of Scotland on this particular act read so you get a little more idea of the detail and tone of this. This would be, with regards to the Book of Common Prayer, the Book of Canons, the Book of Consecration and Ordination, which we haven't talked about, and the General Assembly. I'm sorry, not the General, the Court of High Commission. Okay, so the report, the contemporary report, went as follows. The Assembly, having diligently considered the Book of Common Prayer, lately obtruded upon the Reformed Kirk within this realm, both in respect of the manner of the introducing thereof, and in respect of the matter which it containeth, findeth that it hath been devised and brought in by the pretended prelates, without direction from the Kirk, impressed upon ministers without warrant from the Kirk, to be universally received as the only form of divine service under all highest pains, both civil and ecclesiastical, and the book itself, besides the popish frame and forms in divine worship, to contain many popish errors and ceremonies, and the seeds of manifold and gross superstition and idolatry. The Assembly, therefore, all in one voice, hath rejected and condemned, and by these presents doth reject and condemn the said book, not only as illegally introduced, but also as repugnant to the doctrine, discipline, and order of this Reformed Kirk, to the Confession of Faith, constitutions of General Assembly, and acts of Parliament establishing the true religion, and doth prohibit the use and practice thereof, and ordains presbyteries to proceed with the censure of the Kirk against all such as shall transgress. The Assembly also taking to their consideration the Book of Canons, right, this is the Book of Church Government, and the manner how it hath been introduced, findeth that it hath been devised by the pretended prelates, without warrant or direction from the General Assembly, and to establish a tyrannical power in the persons of the pretended bishops over the worship of God, men's consciences, liberties, and goods, and to overthrow the whole discipline and government of the General and Synodal Assemblies, presbyteries, and sessions formerly established in our Kirk. Therefore the Assembly all in one voice hath rejected and condemned the said book as contrary to the confession of our faith, and repugnant to the established government, the Book of Discipline, and the acts and constitutions of our Kirk. Okay, let's see. We'll skip the part on the Book of Consecration and Ordination. On the High Commission, the General Assembly, after due trial, having found that the Court of High Commission hath been erected without the consent or procurement of the Kirk, or consent of the Estates in Parliament, that it subverteth the jurisdiction and ordinary judicatories and assemblies of the Kirk Sessions, Presbyteries, Provincial, and National Assemblies, that it is not regulated by laws civil or ecclesiastical, but at the discretion and arbitrament of the commissioners, that he giveth to ecclesiastical persons the power of both swords, and to persons merely civil the power of the keys and Kirk censures. Therefore the Assembly all in one voice hath disallowed and condemned the said court as unlawful in itself, and prejudicial to the liberties of Christ's Kirk and Kingdom, the King's honor in maintaining the established laws and judicatories of the Kirk. Okay, so the High Commission had been this court set up by the king, and was really given power over every aspect of life. I mean, it was nominally to deal with ecclesiastical issues, but as they pointed out, it had both the, as it were, the keys to the kingdom and the sword. Now, some of this, of course, I mean, the Court of High Commission was established illegally by the king, so their complaint would only have so much effect, but I get, they did put it on record. I suppose the other part of the court's authority came from the fact that the archbishop sat on it, and since they were about to be deposed, it didn't matter. But Mike, were you going to... Yes. Right. So they'd been under persecution and intimidated and sort of under the thumb of the bishops, as it were, for a number of years. And so Mike is asking, how is it that they all of a sudden came up with this bold statement and so on? It's a good question. I mean, there are some answers in that certainly these things were well considered before the meeting of the assembly. The moderator had appointed to him a number of assessors. These were assistants to help him run the General Assembly. They included many of the leaders of the writers of the National Covenant who'd brought the sort of movement this far. It was some ministers, but it was mostly lay leaders. It was a mix of sort of church leadership and lay leadership. And so even though these people had been under the thumb, they weren't all sort of morally, they weren't all spiritually bankrupt, as it were. They weren't all, didn't necessarily believe the bishops were the right, the right thing. They knew that things were wrong in the church. And, as we've already pointed out, like Samuel Rutherford became a minister, apparently through a sort of sideways ordination, done by one of the bishops that wasn't too Episcopalian, and so on. So there were men in the church that were not that weren't political. But it doesn't fully answer the question. I mean, I guess you probably have to say in God's providence that. Well, Alexander Henderson would be one. There were several earls that were actively involved, like Balmerino, who we remember had been tried for holding a copy of a petition to the king, or having a copy of a petition to the king for, about some of these issues, and mere possession of it earned him a death sentence, which the king had to revoke because he realized it might set off a revolution. There were several other earls that were all sort of leaders of this movement. It also had very wide acceptance. I mean, we did talk about some cases where signing the covenant was probably forced or people felt intimidated into signing it, but by and large, I mean, huge numbers of people signed it of their own free will. So. Okay, let's see. They deposed and excommunicated basically all the archbishops and bishops. Their offenses included violating the caution set down in 1600, Sabbath breaking, falsifying edicts of the assembly, adultery, drunkenness, simony, which I guess I didn't look up, but I've always assumed is stealing money from the church, deposing godly ministers, Arminianism, etc. There's actually a pretty long list of things that they were tried for. They didn't present any defense at all, so they were deposed Actually, I'm not sure that all of them were excommunicated. They were definitely all deposed, but there may have been some that were only deposed and not excommunicated. They banned ministers from having civil offices, right? And this is, although, the way we think today, maybe, that wouldn't be so bad if Bruce was also a representative for the State House. But in that system, it was used, as we've seen, for the king basically to get his way by packing the parliament with people that he appointed. Which is probably another reason, we've discussed some of the things that the king had done that just offended the Scots nobility in general. Just abuses of power. This packing the parliament with these with bishops was one of those things. They appointed regular meetings of the General Assembly, and which had not happened actually for about 20 years. Rob?
What's going on in England at this time?
In England, well, the king, first of all, has alienated a lot of people. The Puritans aren't in open rebellion, but they are definitely at odds with the king. As I recall, he closed the last parliament in about 1630, so he's gone about 10 years without a parliament. The Scots didn't have a sort of a national, call it a myth or whatever, this national ideal of a free parliament, but the English did, and they hadn't had one for 10 years. So, but things hadn't erupted in England yet. It was still sort of boiling under the surface. So
he can't raise money without parliament?
Not much money. You're going to see in the class that he actually gets in. This causes him some heartburn later. So.
Is that why he put mysteries to the church?
Not that I can tell. I don't think he was, as far as I know, he wasn't extracting money directly from them. So, at least I haven't seen any evidence of that. As far as I know, he's putting the screws to the church because he wanted his way, which was bishops that he controlled. So.
Why did you say that he needs to raise the revenue entirely? Got basically the money from the church.
That's entirely possible. I mean, he definitely would have been motivated to do it. So I just haven't seen any, haven't read about that aspect of it. So, I also found this in another source. They prohibited salmon fishing on Sundays. So, the author, that was by in a book by John Buchan, he mentioned that he called it was startling enlightenment. They banned salmon fishing on Sundays. And I was wondering if he was referring to the sort of conservation aspects of this, whereas I'm sure they did it solely for Sabbath-keeping purposes. Okay, they finally adjourned on the 20th December, having nearly nearly rectified nearly 40 years of impositions, persecution, intimidation, and so on of the church. They adjourned by singing the 133rd Psalm. And Henderson is reported to have said, "We have now cast down the walls of Jericho. Let him that rebuildeth them beware of the curse of Hiel the Bethelite." So, okay, well, as we noted already, both sides were arming. And this is going to lead to what was called the First Bishop's War. I'm going to talk about the Covenanter army, but I thought in a class where we're talking about the Tale of Two Kingdoms, I ought to be very precise about this, that this is not an army of the church. This is an army of the tables, right? This committee of states representing the nobles, lairds, gentry, the burgesses, and also the church. It is really an alternative government. So when I talk about the Covenanters fighting and so on, I'm not referring to, you know, the just a bunch of men appointed by the church to go out and fight. They were appointed, drafted, and so on by the tables. Okay, so in early 1639, preparations for war continued. Scottish preparation was very well organized and very thorough. Each shire had representatives in Edinburgh through which information was passed both ways. They had a draft of sorts. This is getting aside from the scope of the class, but one of the books that I was reading was talking about how parts of it were modeled on the Swedish military system, which in turn had been probably brought over by some of the Scottish Protestant officers that had been fighting in some of the European wars, and they called them back to come home and fight. And I like this quote from Donald Stevenson, who's in this book and in another book, pointed out that there are a number of these men, they're basically mercenaries, they fought for a living, and they didn't really care which side they were on. He gives a lot of examples where, 20 of them were supposed to fight for the Covenanters, but their ship got captured, so they fought for the king instead, and so on. Some were strong Protestants and so on, but, you know, some were just basically fighting. Anyway, Stevenson said, "Turner, Monroe, and their like were professional soldiers who welcomed a civil war in their native land, as it gave them opportunity to return home while continuing to make their living in the only way they knew, a somewhat paradoxical form of patriotism." So, but they did hire, the upshot is they actually did hire a bunch of professional soldiers. They actually, certain ranks of officers were only reserved for professional soldiers, which helped them avoid, say, having the nobility, the nobility that, say, didn't know anything running the battle. Also, they appointed Alexander Leslie as their commander, I guess their commander-in-chief. He was about 60 years old. He was a field marshal in the German wars, and apparently worked out well from the standpoint that he was very knowledgeable militarily, and also it kept the nobles from sort of fighting with each other over who was to have this preeminent rank. And basically, they all took, even the nobles who were generals, took orders from Leslie. They again tried to petition the king. They sent a representative to London on the 7th of January, 1639, but he couldn't get any hearing at all, whether from the king or from anyone close to the king. On the 26th of January, Charles sent a letter to the nobility of England stating his plans to raise an army to resist an invasion from Scotland. That's what he told them. As we've already discussed in this question, right, he hadn't had a parliament for 10 years, so it was out of the question raising money in the sort of the usual way and hiring soldiers. He had to instead rely on the nobles to basically raise forces from their lands, sort of a feudal system of raising an army. They were to meet him in York on the 1st of April. So in turn, the Covenanters addressed a general message to all the good Christians in England on the 4th of February and explained their reasons for their position, that they weren't attempting to overthrow the king and so on. And it was said to have a significant effect on public opinion in England. It was certainly read very sympathetically by the Puritans and by others, those who were just in favor of having a parliament, which they hadn't had for 10 years. During February, there were a few minor skirmishes in the northeast part of the country, where the Earl of Huntly was preparing to fight for the king. But he was ordered to avoid confronting them until Charles was ready. This turned out to be a mistake, so one time they sort of met up and they had just slunk away. And he finally ended up disbanding his forces. During March, the Covenanter army, under the Earl of Montrose, captured every suspect castle in the lowlands, or I should say all but one. On the 21st of March, the Covenanter army under Alexander Leslie captured Edinburgh Castle. It was very lightly defended, so this wasn't a major military accomplishment. Basically, it blew open the outer doors with explosives and marched in without firing a shot. By the end of March, nearly every potential royalist stronghold was captured, and at the end of the month, the Covenanter army occupied Aberdeen. I guess I've skipped over this for the rest of my discussion, but Aberdeen was again more sympathetic to the king. It actually changed hands about four times in the next 2 months, and as one side or the other took it over. In the end, it was a non-issue, but Charles had originally planned to land a force there at Aberdeen, meet up with the Earl of Huntly's force, and conquer part of the country from the north down to the south. Charles' plan was to raise 30,000 men for an invasion of Scotland. 5,000 of them landed at Aberdeen to meet up with the Earl of Huntly, and the Earl of Antrim had offered to raise another 10,000 men from Ireland, but he was not as good as his word and wasn't able to raise that many. In fact, the king, recruits came in very slowly, they were very poorly trained, I think by the end of May, they may have had about 16,000 men there. Okay, so in the king still trying to win the propaganda war, came up with a proclamation explaining the cause from his view, which was that basically he was willing to give concessions in religion, but they were trying to overthrow the king. There were a certain number of leaders who were guilty of treason and couldn't be pardoned. And then furthermore, went on to offer a bounty on 19 men's heads. So a number of the earls, I think Alexander Henderson, although he wasn't mentioned by name, was actually a bounty placed on their heads. And Stevenson wrote sort of a fairly lengthy history of this time period, basically said that fortunately they were talked out of it by the other counselors, because if this had happened and many of them had been killed, they would have definitely been martyrs for Scotland. It would just further inflame public opinion. So he relented and just threatened confiscation of the lands of these people. And to their tenants, he offered reduced rents once they were overthrown. So, I guess that's kind of like campaigning for governor, that if you win, you'll lower taxes or something. Okay, well, with Aberdeen being captured, and it changed hands several times, but of course, these were usually short periods and communications not being very good, the Marquis of Hamilton had a fleet of 19 ships carrying 5,000 men. They sailed into the Firth of Forth instead, right? And that's the inlet that Edinburgh sits on the south side of. It makes a big wedge into the country. As it turns out, of the 5,000 men, they were almost completely untrained. Only 200 had ever held a musket before. But while he did sail in the Firth, he did hold up some of the Covenanters, because they couldn't basically go to the borders with this 5,000 men fleet sailing back and forth in the Firth. Oh, and occasionally landing on islands in the Firth, but. Again, a quote from Stevenson: to these difficulties was added the embarrassment, this is of the Marquis of Hamilton, of having his mother, a staunch Covenanter, threaten to shoot him herself if he attempted to land. The Lady Marquis of Hamilton rides on the hides of her troops both day and night with her pistols and carbine. So, anyways.
There's a lot of people you'd be in trouble with.
Not with your mom. The Marquis had grown up pretty much in England. It was a city next to hell. He hated Scotland the most. At one point in all this, he wrote a letter to the king, which he basically despaired of ever accomplishing anything, and thinking he would probably be a martyr for the king's cause. He left instructions that his sons were not to marry anyone from Scotland, and a few other things like that. So in May, he sailed back and forth along the coast, occasionally landing on an island. The king kept changing his mind from day to day as to what should be done. Okay, so the king came to York, he then came up to Berwick, which is right on the border. Basically degenerated to the point where the king, Hamilton said about all he could do, and maybe it was raid some coastal villages, but he'd have to do it quickly because he was running out of supplies. And
Charles, who's still stalling for time, told him to negotiate, you know, so he basically lands with some negotiation, and papers go back and forth, but nobody believes it has anything meaningful. Okay, so by the end of May, Charles had about 16,000 men near Berwick. He attempted to publish a proclamation, perhaps the same proclamation that we earlier discussed, by sending some troops across the border to post this, like on the market square. And previously, the Scottish troops were obeying an order by the king. He'd ordered them not to bring their troops within 10 miles of the border, and they'd honored that until he sent the troops across. So they came and occupied the village of Kelso. And on the 3rd of June, Charles, not liking that, sent a force of 3,300 men to drive them out of Kelso. They were heavily outnumbered by the Scots, panicked, and fled back across the border. So, of course, for morale on the English side, this isn't doing a whole lot of good. So, and as I mentioned, there were also a few skirmishes in the northeast part of Scotland, but just basically for a quote, war, very little bloodshed. I mean, some people were killed, but not large numbers. So finally, Charles decided to negotiate with the Scots, and on the 11th of June, they started working out a treaty. He continued to stall and kept making these impossible demands. This went on for a week, so finally the Scots told him that if he didn't, change his tune, that they would bring the army within a cannon shot of his camp. And so then he sort of finished up and made the treaty. This is a so-called Treaty of Berwick, sometimes referred to as the Pacification of Berwick. In other words, it was an attempt to pacify the Scots. But unfortunately, or regrettably, the terms of the written agreement were pretty vague, and the king made a number of verbal promises. He said he didn't want to put down on paper because it wouldn't look good for him abroad to be sort of making all these concessions. But in fact, once they split, he reneged on all the verbal promises. And these terms of the treaty caused some disappointment and division within the Covenanters. So the terms were both sides were to disband their forces, the Covenanters were to return the king's castles, and they were to cease all unauthorized meetings. The king was to summon a general assembly to meet in Edinburgh on the 6th of August, and a parliament which would meet with the purpose of ratifying the general assembly's actions. Okay, so he made a number of verbal promises, including the General Assembly could elect elders. This is one of the things he'd argued with before. He didn't like them electing elders because he had control over the ministers, but he didn't have control over the lay elders. He supposedly agreed that a free General Assembly is one which chose its own makeup, right? And that's what James and Charles had been fighting all along. They'd been packing the meeting. Anyways, the outcome of all this is a very short period of peace, and so there's the First Bishop's War, which ended in June 1639, and then next week we'll certainly get to the Second Bishop's War, which started the next year. So it was sort of a short period of peace, but basically neither side really believed that their objectives had been met, and Charles realized basically that by June of 1639, he didn't have the forces. Some of his advisors had been advising him to stall and to attack later, and he finally basically gave up, signed this treaty, and with the idea that he would go back and win the battle another day, or win the war another day. Questions? Bob?
If Charles had not expanded Parliament, would he have had money to raise the large enough army to invade Scotland?
If Parliament agreed with him. It's not at all clear that they would have. One of Charles' character traits, or leadership, his management style, as it were, is he didn't tell anybody his reasons for anything. So, in fact, even this letter to the English nobility, his view was that Scottish policy was basically his business. So he didn't even tell them why he was raising, why he felt it necessary to go. So, I mean, it theoretically, it's possible if Parliament had been in session, they could have voted him the money and so on to raise a real army. But I guess I doubt it. So.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is this is going to drive the power and disband his parliament. I mean, it was basically an act to say, I don't need Trump. I can raise this money without Trump. Did that actually cause him to fail, ultimately? Is that driving the power?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. It was that, and it wasn't just Parliament, it was the way he sort of treated everybody else, too. Was that he'd grown up on this, you know, James's maxims being an absolute and free monarch, which meant that, you know, you just had absolute power, could order everybody else to do everything that you wanted. And of course, it didn't work out like that. I think that's ultimately not only cost him this war and the next war, but ultimately his life was finally executed in the English Civil War. So, yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose money and the ability to raise troops, which could have been solved with money, or could have possibly been solved if people were really motivated to, you know, if they really felt there was some serious threat to England, which he was trying to act as if there were, as if the Scots were going to come in and march down and kidnap him. But since he neither had money nor motivation, I think that really cost him. And the troops that he did have, they weren't very motivated either. So, okay. Other questions? Okay. Well.
What can all the money did with rebellion in Scotland and the change of the plan? Did he have a source of revenue with the church property?
As far as I know, what he had done was he had basically previously given back these lands to the bishops. And as far as I know, that mostly came out of the nobility's pocket. Now, whether or not they were funneling money from their rents to the king, it's certainly possible. I just don't know. My impression at the time he was doing it was to sort of completely reestablish episcopacy, and in order to do that, you had to make like these archbishops be some kind of like princes. They had to have sort of big estates and so on in order to really establish themselves as bishops. But it's entirely possible that he could be giving them a kickback. I just haven't seen any discussion of it or evidence of it in any of the books I've been reading, Christian or secular. So, but I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, that's possible. Okay. Well, Simon, would you close us in prayer?
Thank you.